Today's program is brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com.
Hi, this is Joe Campanelli, the host of In the Drink. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. We are Groundworks, Inc. I'm Alice Marcus-Krieg.
And I'm Carmen DeVito.
And we design, install, and maintain gardens in and around New York City. So we deal with soil and watering systems and hauling plants to roofs and through houses. But today's show is a little bit different.
Wait, before you begin, Alice, we have to talk about... talk about our award that we just got.
All right.
Yes.
Do tell.
Alice and I were not able to go to the Garden Writers Association conference this
Pasadena.
Year. Pasadena. Bummer. We really wanted to go. But we did get a silver award this year for best...
Talent.
Best radio talent.
and so tonight we're
up
waiting
for the gold, yes.
With bated breath. We're up for the gold award. So
we just wanted to give ourselves a little pat on the back today. And we'll let you know if we win gold. We'll be posting about that shortly. But anyway, continue.
Okay. So for me, the subject of today's show started because I have a 3.5-year-old. With an episode of Octonauts.
Oh, yes. I don't know what an octonaut is.
It is a underwater explorer. It's
Ooh.
A cartoon. It started as a British cartoon, and now there's an American version. So I started with one episode with my 3.5-year-old of Octonauts, and then I graduated to a series of Octonauts, and now all the episodes, and we own them. And then we started getting really into it, and my husband got a fish tank, and he got some... plants for the tank, and then he got some more plants for the tank and for the fish, and then the garden designer in me got super nerdy, and I got really into like designing this fish tank,
yeah.
Right? Because we're looking at it all the time. It sits on our table right where we eat. And so I started looking at the color and the texture and the form and, you know, the arrangement of the plants next to each other, just as we do in a garden. And then it dawned on me, I know nothing about marine plants. So what do? I go to the government, right? I go to the source and I say, I think to myself, who can educate me on marine plants? So I sent an email to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and in particular, the Ocean Department, Ocean tab on the website. And after a few emails, I learned of some work being done by Dr. Michael Graham of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary and Cal State. He is an expert on kelp forests, and he is our guest today. Welcome.
Hi, ladies. How are you?
Good.
We're so glad you could join us. We really struck...
I struck gold. I struck gold, and I'll tell you why. Kelp gold, when I read your bio, and I realized that Dr. Graham is a consultant on Octonauts and Finding Nemo and Big Blue Live. So here I am, like the, you know, I'm at the epicenter. I'm deep
of
in the
knowledge.
Kelp forest.
Yes.
Of kelp forest.
Keeping it real.
So welcome, Dr. Graham.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Yeah.
So let's tell our audience a little bit about you. You have a very impressive resume, which we cannot possibly read on air.
Seven pages.
But in brief, you are the professor of marine ecology at the Moss Landing Marine Lab in San Jose, California, co-editor of the Journal of Phycology, have held numerous teaching fellowships, written quote-unquote oceans of papers on algae, and have won several...
Bad pun.
And have won several awards for your work in ecology and scientific methodology. So you are just the person we need to shed some lights on plants of the deep.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm really happy to be here. I have had a diverse career in looking at algae and seaweeds around the world, and I've been lucky enough to do a lot of outreach projects which have really gotten me to talk to a bunch of different groups, one of which is now you, and so I'm really happy to kind of let you into my world today and see if I can help you and your listeners get a little bit better understanding of this group that you might not be too familiar with.
Well, that's exactly what is so fascinating because, you know, as I was for my own education, looking at the plants for this freshwater fish tank that we have, you know, I was like noticing the names were somewhat similar. And then it just started to, I just started thinking like, I really know nothing about this. And some of these plants, I knew the root word because of the Latin.
Right.
So it was similar. But then I was like, wow, this is a huge world that not many people know about. So please tell us, how did you get interested in this as a young person, and then tell us like what specifically your concentration is.
Okay, absolutely. Yeah, I grew up on a beach in Southern California where I was a surfer and a volleyball player and a scuba diver as a child, and just, you know, that scenario of just being there, I mean, it's so ocean in Southern California on the beach.
Uh-huh.
And one of the very conspicuous things is kelp forests. We have these really large kelp forests, which I'll talk a little bit about later. They really are the redwood forests of the sea. I mean, these things are 150 feet long. They grow at almost 2 feet a day.
Right.
I mean, they're absolutely incredible, and I was just struck as a child that this was just such a cool system. So I knew really early on that I wanted to be a marine biologist, and there's a lot of wonderful places to do this down in Southern California. So I spent some time at Santa Barbara, another wonderful place, but had a great marine biology program, and then I just kept going. I have a really nice pedigree of moving along to these wonderful institutions and getting as I was in college for 13 years to get all my degrees.
Yeah.
Necessary to come back and teach what I do. And so I've spent my whole career near the coast, but, you know, I study algae, and I think what I think people get a little confused with, you know, you mentioned I'm the editor of Journal of Phycology. Phycology is the study of algae.
Right.
Botany is the study of plants. And there's a little bit of a distinction here. You know, there's lots of algae in the world, and they're as old as 1.8 billion years old, whereas plants are about 200,000 years old. And what it is, you know, for us, there's seaweeds. There's reds, there's greens, and there's browns. It's the green seaweeds that finally made themselves into fresh water and then ultimately onto land to give rise to our green plants that we're all familiar with. There's a whole bunch of seaweeds and other algae that never made that journey, and that's what the phycologists study. And these are things as simple as little cells to, like I said, these glorious kelp forests around the planet.
That is exactly the explanation that we needed.
Yes.
And that Carmen and I spend a lot of time thinking about plant migration and also the commerce of it and the
yes.
countries that were built because of plant migration, right? And plant hunting. And,
yes. Yes.
So of the ocean world, do plants migrate within ocean systems?
Absolutely. We don't generally call it migration because migration is almost like an act of determination. You know,
right,
you know
yeah.
the animals follow each other across continents. Algae disperse. Much like plants, you know, do with, mm-hmm. with pollen. But what they do is they generally have spores and they disperse. But I wanted to tell you two stories about plant dispersal globally that are quite interesting and that your listeners might like. So the first one is I work with giant kelp. This is the one I was telling you about that's really large. It has these floats on it. So the seaweed makes these little air pockets, and that allows it to buoy it up and form this canopy in the ocean. Well, when you detach that, say, due to waves, those plants will then drift. And we've noticed that they can drift thousands of kilometers and still be able to drop their spores. So this is how they really move north, south, east, and west within the Pacific Ocean and the Atlantic Ocean and the Southern Ocean. And one of the greatest stories is that these plants, these algae, they evolved in California, but they ultimately made it across the equator to South America and Peru, all the way down the west coast of South America, and then Argentina, the Falkland Islands, South Africa. It just got caught up in the currents. And this has all probably only been in the last, you know, 20 or 30,000 years. So these organisms really can make those migrations, and sometimes even quicker, because once they get in the currents, they just go with the flow.
Right.
And one of the interesting parts of this is we've actually done some anthropological work on this, and we think that, in fact, this connectivity, this large connectivity between these seaweeds and these continents were really important in helping people move from the northern hemisphere to the southern hemisphere in regards to North America and South America, because they had all those resources already distributed along these coasts. We actually call it the kelp highway. And the idea is, as these people are moving from North America to South America, they just follow the kelp forest. They have all the resources that we all love, abalone and lobsters and sea otters, right there. And that's all being caused by the fact that the seaweed was able to make that original migration itself.
So that's extraordinary, because you answered the question that I was going to ask next, how it impacted human civilizations.
Right.
That's and seaweed is a very important, Allison, as she mentioned, we're very interested in the economics of botany and how plants impact people. You know, seaweed is so important.
I mean, you only
culturally and
but I only really think of seaweed as a Japanese industry, you know, because
of their culinary traditions.
Yeah. So why haven't other human cultures adapted this?
Well, there's that's a little trickier of an answer. The reason seaweeds have actually been utilized forever.
Uh-huh.
That whole thing I just told you about of seaweeds making to South America, we know this happened because around 14,000 years ago, we have an ancient kitchen site down in South America, down in Chile, and you know there's charred remains of animals, but there's charred seaweed in there, and so that's how we knew 14,000 years ago that they were using seaweed, at least in their kitchen, whether or not they were eating or not. So it is pretty old. Now, in the eastern hemisphere, there is quite a bit of use in the Atlantic regions. There's a seaweed called dulse, which you can easily find in the Whole Foods markets or any of the markets on the East Coast. It's a dried form, and that's been used for centuries. And in fact, I think the Celts were early on with that in Europe. And so I think what happened was in Asia, right at the end of World War II, there was this need to really help to develop industry in that region, and one of which was seaweed farming. Prior to that, seaweed farming was done at a very local scale, but once there was this industrialization, it took off, and at that point, they made more seaweed than they could utilize in Japan and then later Korea and China, and now they supply it to the whole world, especially with our big sushi kick worldwide. You know, you can't wrap sushi unless you have that nice little seaweed paper, and so now globally, you know, everyone's eating seaweed, and that's why it really does come out. It's really hard for the rest of us to start up that industry because it really does require a lot of infrastructure.
Mm-hmm. And isn't samphire, isn't that also a marine plant?
What plant?
I think it's called samphire, S-A-M-P-H-I-R-E. It's a green, I think it's a green marine plant that's also eaten as a vegetable.
I don't know that one in particular, but there are hundreds of seaweeds and sea plants. There's actually some real plants called seagrasses that have made it back into the ocean. There's hundreds that have been utilized. In fact, there's entire books, you know, there's a book on the West Coast here called Sea Vegetables, and, you know, it's basically a cookbook that tells you how to go and pick seaweeds off the shore, how to clean them and process them, and what their nutritional value is. So I think the main populace in the United States and worldwide might not be used to it, but there's a bunch of local groups that have been doing this for a long time and really enjoy it.
Yeah, there was just I was reading an article when I was doing a little research on you, and I guess there was a big bloom recently, I think this July, and it was all washing up on the beach and people were kind of freaking out, right? And I guess
that was actually that's a seaweed called sea lettuce. It's called ulva.
Yeah,
it's a It's a green blade, and it actually does a lot of this on your coast as well. Mm-hmm. Up north in Rhode Island is quite famous for having these blooms in these bays. And the most famous one is the one that happened in China during the Olympics.
Right.
The whole bay bloomed with the seaweed, and they had to shut down the sailing until they can get the People's Army out there to clear it. It was just an amazing story. And everyone freaks out. You're right. And I keep thinking, why? Because the seaweed that's doing it is, one, it's doing it naturally. We don't really anticipate that there's a lot of human input. But it's the most edible seaweed in the world. It's called sea lettuce.
Right.
So, you know, I kind of joked and say, hey, walk on down to the shore and grab yourselves a little bit of a crunchy bite, because it was all dried up by then.
But, I loved the recipe that was included for the soup. It was, you know, chicken stock and onion and scallion and the sea lettuce, and it sounded amazing.
So, Michael,
it really is.
I'm guessing that you do eat a good amount.
I'm a fanatic for seaweed. I eat a lot of seaweed myself.
Yeah.
And I think people would be very surprised how flavorful and unique it is. So it'd be really great if others got to enjoy it.
Is there much of medical research going on for medicinals from seaweed?
It's actually very large, and you know, me as editor of my journal, I get a lot of papers submitted. But in the biomedical research, it's huge. The reason is that certain species of seaweed accumulate tremendous amounts of iodine, up into the 1,000% per daily, you know, requirements that we have.
Mm-hmm.
So, and they've known this forever in Asian cultures. They've used kelp as a replacement for iodized salt.
Mm-hmm.
And so kelp tablets are available everywhere. It's, you know, it's a supplement. It's not an actual, you know, medicine or that type of nutritional value, but it is a supplement. And people use it for goiter and all the things where they have iodine-related issues.
Uh-huh.
So that one's huge. But we're also finding now that there's a lot of stuff in seaweeds that are very analogous to the things like lycopene, right? These
special tomato,
chemicals,
right,
that we know in like cranberries and pomegranates.
Mm-hmm.
We're finding similar stuff in seaweeds. We're finding antioxidants. We're finding antivirulence. We're finding anti-inflammatories and blood thinners. And it's just exploding right now with the interest in algae, and mostly because we can contain these and grow them in a totally different way than we do plants. It doesn't require thousands of acres in Nebraska,
right,
to grow a bunch of blue-green algae cells. It requires a lot of tanks in a totally different scenario. So I think there's an explosion of interest in the last 10 years.
Right. Do you know the work of the British photographer Anna Atkins?
I don't. No, I haven't heard of her.
Oh, she, you should look her up. She was at the turn of the century. She was photographing algae and marine plant life. And the artwork is exquisite. And actually, one of our clients is a curator, and she curated kind of a new show, a contemporary show of her work at the Drawing Center. And the catalogs, unfortunately, there's no more catalogs in circulation because they all got...
And they were cyanotypes, right? They were blue.
Yeah, they were
blue. So it's incredible. It's like blue and white coloring.
You would love them.
They were British. All the British.
And she
algae.
was considered the first woman photographer.
Yeah.
Too. And her subject matter is British algae.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what she chose to photograph, and they're incredible.
Anna Atkins.
Well, algae are very delicate, and they really have an amazing presentation. They're extremely diverse, and almost all of their structures are unfamiliar to us because we're so used to flowers and
uh-huh.
the other structures we see in terrestrial plants that I think you're right. When someone like that who is able to capture it, it really is stunning for the rest of us. I mean, you can see my office right now. I have an entire wall of photographs of just seaweed,
yeah.
as well as my children. but seaweed everywhere, just because there really is a very aesthetically pleasing look to seaweed, and they can be very creative.
Well, I was I have a 3.5-year-old, and I love the ocean, and I grew up at the Outer Banks as a kid, and up in Maine, and I want my child to grow up, you know, with free and easy access to the ocean as well. And so we went to the beach a lot, just for day trips, in New York here this summer. And at one point he was having a total meltdown, like just a total meltdown. I think he didn't want me to put sunscreen on him or something. So I just grabbed all this seaweed and I put it all over my body like a mermaid. And he just thought it was like the most hilarious, hilarious thing. And those pods that you can pop and they make that pop sound. Do you know?
Oh, that helped them float, right?
Yeah.
Those are like air sacs or something, right?
Yep. Yeah, they're called nematocysts. They're also called aerocysts, and that's on the bladder rack. That's exactly what I was describing about allowing these things to move, because that seaweed actually came from England. That seaweed you're talking about made the migration from England over to our coast, and it was those little bladders that allowed them to do that.
I love the interplay of... and the sharing, you know, I think that's the most important thing about oceans. And, you know, every single time I stand on the coast, I always think, yep, right out there is Ireland. There it is, you know?
Like, yes.
You know, it's just amazing the way the oceans connect everything. And
it's free flowing.
Yeah, it is free flowing. So, as is our dialogue. Hang on one second. We have to take a break. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network.
You are listening to Spreadin' Honey by the California Honey Drops. This is We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
When you get up in the morning, cause it won't be long before you're dead and gone.
Yeah,
no, there ain't no telling. Yeah, we all just bet. Just plant our hands till the last stand. So tell your mama you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your brother you've been spreading honey, won't you? Tell your sister you've been spreading honey.
If I had a magic wand, tomorrow everyone in the world would have enough food to eat that was culturally appropriate and delicious. The planet would be thriving because all the food would have been grown and produced in a way that sustains us, both our bodies and our world. But man, I do not have a magic wand. What I do have is you and this radio station, the Heritage Radio Network. That's what we're here to do. We're here to help lead the way to a future that's more delicious, that's more fun, where we're healthier, where the planet's healthier, and we want you to be a part of that. We can't do it without you. As a nonprofit radio station, we depend on the support of our listeners. So take a minute out of your day, visit the website, and click the big beating donate tab. Throw us a few bucks. Every bit helps. We're counting on you.
Hello out there. It's Steve Jenkins. I'm with Fairway Markets. White Leghorn, Red Wattle, Bourbon Red, Navajo Churro. Well, these aren't names you're likely to hear at a Fairway butcher counter or any other counter today, but before the rise of factory farming, you would have. And at Heritage Foods USA, you still do. Heritage Foods USA exists to promote genetic diversity, small family farms, and a fully traceable food supply. You see, we believe the best way to help a family farmer is to buy from them. And Heritage Foods is honored to represent a network of family farmers and artisanal producers whose work presents an immeasurable gift to our food system and to biodiversity. The meat we celebrate, whether it's heritage turkey, Japanese steaks, Berkshire pork, or Navajo churro lamb chops, is the righteous kind from healthy animals of sound genetics that have been treated humanely and allowed to pursue their natural instincts. It's a simple fact. Animals raised according to this philosophy taste better. And as we like to say, you have to eat them to save them. Visit us at heritagefoodsusa.com for more information.
Hi, welcome back. You're listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. And today we're talking about plants of the ocean, seaweeds, algaes, with Dr. Michael Graham. So, Michael, let's talk about how climate change is affecting these kelp forests that you're studying and working with.
Well, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, the climate is changing worldwide. And some places the Earth seems to be getting a little bit colder, and a lot of other places it seems to be getting a little bit warmer. And our summers are hotter and our winters are colder. It's just this really weird time right now. And most of that affects all of us in different ways. But for seaweeds, you know, the two real big important things are sea level. Because, as we all know, you know, sea levels are rising because of what's going on, and that changes where seaweeds can grow. It's kind of a difficult thing to, you know, to predict. You know, we hear these stories about island countries shrinking in size and the coast of Florida becoming quite different. And at one point, that will change the way seaweeds are distributed because, you know, they need to attach. And so if there's a lot more beaches, then there's less rock for them attached to, et cetera. But the one that's really, I think, most important for kelps is that they need nutrients. And just like plants on land, we need light and water and nutrients, and that's how photosynthesis is driven. And the same thing occurs in the ocean. Well, we have plenty of water. Algae are able to accommodate seawater just fine, and we have quite a bit of light. It's those nutrients that are critical, and they happen in certain areas of the world at a much higher level than other areas. And these, I always make the joke, that anywhere in the world that it's great to make red wine is also another great place to have kelp. And it's the same process. It's called upwelling, where cold water comes up from deep. It makes for a foggy coastline and really wonderful Cabernet Sauvignons. This would be California and Chile and South Africa and Australia, New Zealand. These are all great kelp places as well because of that upwelling. What we're worried about is as climates change and as waters warm and as winds change, that those upwelling centers might start to act differently. And if that happens, then these really large areas of the world that form these giant kelp forests, they're going to change. Now, do I think it's the end of the world? No, it's not going to be the end of the world. But people's lives will change because, for example, in Monterey, we're one of the most picturesque places on the planet. And we're you know, conspicuously surrounded by kelp. If climate continues to change the way it is now, we might still be surrounded by kelp, but it might be a different species. It might not be as plentiful as we once expected, and our kelp forests might have moved up to the coast of Oregon or Washington, or sometimes even as high as Alaska. Mm-hmm. So I think we're going to see things shift, just like we see in land, with plants migrating, as you were saying, with climate change as well.
So you mentioned wine, right, and the upwelling.
Sorry.
No. I think this is a freshwater question, and this might not be a comfortable question for you. What about the Great Lakes? Are there big? Is that an algae producing area? The Great Lakes.
Yeah. Yes, it is. And so, you know, there's algae that grow in freshwater and seawater. A lot of what goes on up in the Great Lakes is done by freshwater algae. There's also a lot of plants that live in the ocean. So the difference between algae and what we call hydrophytes are real terrestrial plants that have gone back into the water. These are the things you see in streams and lakes.
Okay.
They're different, but they kind of grow in the same environment. And so the Great Lakes right now does a lot of the microalgae, the ones that are single cells that you can only really see with a microscope.
Uh-huh.
The big influences there are going to be the stuff we put in the water, right? Mm-hmm. Algae need light. And so as we cloud waters, as lakes become more sometimes polluted, mm-hmm. But also cloudy because there's more sediment or turbidity, which is what we call that cloudiness, that's going to decrease the light for the algae. If we pump in, and we've known this forever, that if you pump in phosphates, that was that whole thing about dumping detergent into lakes, the algae respond. And so right now, and it depends on where you are in the world. In California, the big thing is water. We don't have any water in California.
Right.
But you guys do, and so I don't really know the processes that go on more in the Midwest or on the Eastern Coast. But if you start to change the quality of the water, the algae are going to respond. And in some ways, since they're the base of the food web,
yeah,
the food chain, the trout, the bluegill, the shrimp, and all those things that everyone loves to see when they go to lakes, they're going to change.
Mm-hmm. Well, I grew up on Long Island Sound, and my brother was actually a lobsterman after he got his degree from Yale. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden the industry died because the lobsters went away. And because there was all this dumping, this toxic dumping into the Sound from upstate in Connecticut down the rivers. And they've stopped the dumping. They've been doing the cleaning. But I have noticed that when I go to the beach there, there's not, the seaweed isn't like it was when I was a kid. I have noticed that. And that's like 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there's been there's definitely observations of that happening around the world in exactly those types of scenarios. Mm-hmm. The good thing is there's two good things. One, seaweeds are weeds; they respond really fast. Mm-hmm. So it's when you do finally get around to cleaning up the water, it generally is the seaweed that comes in quick. It might not be the ones that you remember seeing. They might be the slower responders, mm-hmm. but in general, they come in quick. The other thing is, and we do that, we're starting to do this on this coast, seaweeds can be part of the solution because they take up nutrients so quickly. And sometimes, especially on your coast, a lot of the problem is the pollutants and the nutrients coming in the water. The seaweeds can take those up, and they can help to bioremediation. They can help to clean and cleanse the water
right.
for you. So there's a huge industry, and I think there's some going on in Long Island Sound right now. There's some researchers at University of Connecticut that are very interested in using these kind of bioreactors where you bring the dirty water into these seaweed systems and you clean it up and you put the clean water back into the environment. And so it is possible that seaweed might ultimately be both the solution and then part of the recovery as well.
Well, there's actually, I'm not sure if you are aware of the Gowanus Canal, which is here in Brooklyn, which was a turn-of-the-century canal fabricated for industry.
Industrial waste.
Industrial. It was, it was a canal. It was supposed to allow the barges in into deeper Brooklyn, and then the turbine broke down over time, so it's just this stagnant water. And so it's a Superfund cleanup site, and one of the design proposals is called a sponge park, and the landscape architect actually copyrighted that term, sponge park, for exactly what you're describing, the sponge effect of filtration and plant material. Now, these are not aquatic plants that she's thinking about. She's thinking about land plants and bringing back the marsh that actually was there. But yeah, it's that same idea of cleansing through plant material.
Yeah, and what we've been trying to push on this coast is to add, if you do the land plants, is we add the algae as well, because it's like when you're in your garden, you know that there's natural herbicides that are available. When you put these plants near other plants, they can help, support the overall system and help keep pests down, for example. Right. Well, when you do the land-based cleaning, if you throw algae in there as well, it helps to take out some of the chemicals that the plants didn't take.
Right.
And so taking that diverse approach would be really great. And it's really wonderful to hear that this is happening, at a bigger picture on your coast, because I think it's going to be the wave of the future right now to help us solve some of our problems.
Right. That and oysters.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they're part and parcel, as you said, as part of an entire ecosystem. And I had a question about that ecosystem a little bit. So you start with the algae. And then the kelp. Tell us a little bit about the marine animals that have, the sort of symbiotic relationship with these marine plants.
Well, there's quite so. I'm really lucky. I work in a kelp forest that has hundreds of species in it. Mm-hmm. It really is like going to a coral reef or a tropical rainforest. And so, what it starts off with is these 150-foot plants. That what they do is they make a whole bunch of little pieces. When they grow, they just it's like the litter that comes off of a forest. But they're really small pieces, and they get eaten by everything. And these can be little snails, but some of the most common are these little crustaceans. They look like pill bugs that you would see in your garden. They're just the right size to eat these little teeny particles. These little particles are like, they're like skin flakes. They're really small. And what happens is those little animals are in the gazillions, if that's a formal term for a number throughout the kelp forest. And they're the perfect bite size for the little fishes, which are obviously the perfect bite size for the bigger fishes. And so this really does work up kind of like that cartoon food web you always remember when you're seeing a kid, is a whole bunch of little stuff giving rise to a little less slightly bigger stuff, and you have a pyramid.
Right.
And it really works that way out here. Now, the cool part is that the kelp is growing so fast that it makes so much food all the time that we're able to keep the abundances of all of these organisms there because it's just a really plentiful system. And the kelp grows year-round. You know, on your coast, your trees generally drop their leaves, you know, in the fall, and there's not much in the winter. Well, year-round, our kelp forests are just pumping it out. And so, you know, we've got some unbelievable systems out here where all these little animals are cruising around. And often you don't see them because you brought up that symbiotic, you know, notion. We have things like kelp fish that mm-hmm. are perfectly disguised to look like a kelp blade. We have some snails that are the exact color of the kelp, so as they crawl up and down, you can't see them. We have other organisms that if you remove the kelp, they disappear. The abalone need the kelp. It's one of the tastiest organisms in the world is an abalone. And it, if you take the kelp out, it dies. It needs that food source. It's become so accustomed to that food source that it can't survive without it. And we think that it's probably about 30% of all organisms in the kelp forest ultimately depend on it to be there. And if kelp forests shrink, then those species will suffer.
Okay, let me ask you this question, and this might be a really silly, elementary, stupid question. But why do we have kelp forests in the Atlantic? Is our water too warm? Or how come we only think of kelp on the West Coast?
Well, you think of kelp on the West Coast because we got the big ones.
Okay.
But no, in fact, you know, you were bringing up the lobsters. I actually worked when I was a grad student for a researcher in Maine mm-hmm. who was in the lobster industry up there. And yes, you do. Your kelp stops right around Connecticut. It just kind of, it does become too warm.
Okay.
But you do have kelp all throughout the north end of that. Canada is extremely famous for having large kelp beds. Now, mm-hmm. at this point, they're more like... what were those plants that we had in our garden? Like the elephant ear, you know, plants that you have in the garden with the, you know, the leaf might be 2 or 3 feet long.
Mm-hmm.
Mm, okay.
That's the kind of kelp you guys have. You don't have these big floating forests, but you've got these ones that are like the size of ferns. So you can almost think of them as kelp grottos instead of kelp forests.
Okay. Now, are these rooted in the bottom of the ocean floor or are they just free floating?
They're all rooted on the bottom of the floor. The kelps are. They have what's called a holdfast that holds them to the rocks so they don't wash away. They kind of look like roots, but they're not really roots. They don't, you know, roots and plants are only to bring in nutrients.
Right.
These are solely to hold you to the rock.
Okay.
And in fact, you could tie your boat up to it. If you're out there kayaking and you see some kelp, it's weathered the worst storms possible, so you can tie your kayak up to it. Now, there's something special on your coast. It's not an actual kelp. It's a big brown seaweed, but it's not a real kelp. It floats out in the middle of the Atlantic. It's called the Sargasso Sea.
Yeah.
Yes, I was going to ask you about that.
And the turtles. Yeah.
The Great Sargasso
Sea. Exactly.
Sea.
And that is one of the world's most unique systems. It's absolutely amazing. That seaweed just floats around there. See, on our coast here, we have a bigger problem. What floats around the Pacific Ocean is a bunch of trash, plastic bottles and stuff. But you've got this beautiful brown forest that just sits out there, and there's animals that have been living there forever, and they've been adapted to that. There's this frogfish that looks like it, and these seahorses that look like that seaweed, and that seaweed never touches the ground. It's always floating, and it just sits out there and grows.
Yeah. I watched an amazing documentary about the sea turtles and that forest and the symbiotic relationship.
Where exactly is it geographically?
It's right smack in the middle of the Atlantic. There's this current that just basically flows around the Atlantic, and it's kind of like a whirlpool, so it aggregates things to the middle of it.
Yeah.
And so the Gulf Stream's coming up the left side, and there's another current that goes down on the east side, and it's just right. So Columbus had to sail through it, basically, to get over here. And all the ships that sail directly from London to New York, they go right through the Sargasso Sea. You can actually see it on Google Earth. If you get on Google Earth and just take a line out to London from where you guys are, you'll hit it.
And how wide is it?
It's thousands of kilometers wide.
Okay. Now, let's talk about that big floating island of trash that's in between Japan and the United States. How is that affecting the kelp forests?
It doesn't affect the kelp forest necessarily because it stays out there in the middle of the Pacific.
Uh-huh.
We call it the Great Pacific Trash. It's a trash pile. I mean, it's just unbelievable how bad it is.
Yeah, Google
Earth. And that's all the bottles. And, you know, there's also a lot of trash out there from, you know, the whole Fukushima disaster that we had,
yeah.
you know, because that's where that ends up. So it doesn't necessarily affect us. It is aesthetically, of course, a very unpleasant thing to know that we have that out there. But there's an enormous amount of organisms that live out in that part of the ocean that are severely impacted. And you keep bringing up turtles, which means someone on the phone or over there really likes turtles like I do.
Yeah.
And this is a horrible thing for turtles.
Yeah.
Plastic is probably one of the worst things for sea turtles because they think they're jellyfish. And, you know, you'll have sea turtles that wash up on shore. And when they finally get into an autopsy, they realize their stomach is full of plastic bags and lids from bottles and just all the stuff that's floating out there. So it really is a horrible thing.
I know. So are you a diver? Are you swimming around down there?
I am. I'm a scuba diver.
Yeah. Tell us about some of the, what, like, when you're doing an experiment, tell us what that's like.
So it's diving is, it's just a very unique experience, and so most people are out there in warm water, in the coral reefs, and I've done that diving, and it's absolutely incredible. Well, I told you, kelp doesn't like warm water. It likes cold water, and cold water has nutrients, which means there's all these little particles in the water, and it's not that clear.
Mm-hmm.
Some days I'll go scuba diving. I'll be diving at, you know, 30 feet, and I won't be able to see 6 inches in front of me because all the plankton are eating up those nutrients and are just it's like swimming in a big, giant bucket of tea.
Yeah.
And so you start to learn how to do things by touch. And so my students and I, you know, you kind of figure out how to count the size of the plants and find the plants without really having much vision. It'd be kind of like going through at night trying to find the light switch in your house, and you kind of remember where you're at. And that's how it actually is a lot of times. And then other days, everything's clear, and you can see across this like a big valley, and you see these plants and sea otters, and it's just amazing. And you know, as a scientist, we don't get to pick the days we really go out. We have to just go do our work.
Right.
But I'll spend days, you know, counting plants. I'll look at their growth rate. I'll see how many babies are arriving. I'll go see if there's anything conspicuously eating them. It's almost like when you go through your garden and you tend. We do a lot of tending. We basically want to see, are there any symptoms of good stuff going on? Any symptoms of bad stuff going on? Are there any species we haven't seen before? And then all the species we love to see all the time, we just want to make sure they're still around, and are they having good years or bad years? So we do a lot of bit of that. And then a lot of times we do experiments, and my students, you know, when they ask for birthday presents from their parents, they want a Home Depot card because they got to go get a bunch of concrete and PVC pipe because they're out there doing actual experiments where they're trying to look at how snails affect kelp and, you know, what happens when you shade plant. All the stuff we've done on land forever, we're just starting to do that underwater right now, and it's really fun seeing these guys. I always joke with them, they're usually a little too young to remember MacGyver, but I'm sure we all remember MacGyver who goes out and fixes everything.
Yeah.
Well, these kids have to figure out how to do that underwater.
Yeah.
And it's just really fun watching them use their creativity to solve problems.
Okay, so last question. Unfortunately, we have to wrap things up, but it's fascinating. What an amazing world. Thank you for sharing. What do you think is the most important takeaway that our listeners can leave with?
In regards to seaweeds and algae, I think it's that algae have been an important part of human lives forever, but even more so now that we're understanding what they actually do, I think people are going to find them useful and a pleasant part. They're no longer going to be the types of things that you kind of kick off the sand so you can lay down your beach towel when you're on the beach. I think people are starting to appreciate it for things like biofuel and fertilizer, and you were talking health and human consumption. And so I would hope people start to look at it like that, as opposed to, you know, the slimy negative connotation that algae have I think had, and
right.
I think purposely so in the past. But there's a lot out there for people to explore with algae, and there's places to go. You know, please Google phycology, Google algae, and see all the stuff we have to offer on the web.
So I think the Phycology Society needs a really amazing marketing campaign, right? Algae. Algae.
It's the future.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you so much. What a treasure it's been to speak with you. And thank you for all of your work on Octonauts and for getting me excited. And anything else that you want to plug? Is there anything in particular that you guys are looking for research and grant money on, or something that where
we can
help?
Or any special events or articles coming out?
Well, actually, so that you did bring it up, the Phycological Society of America is the largest institution worldwide for the study of algae. And we do get confused with the Psychological Society.
Yeah.
But we are becoming very big with high schools and elementary schools and getting kids involved. So, yes, if you could point them to PSA, it's the Phycological Society of America. There's a lot of push right now, and this is a volunteer run organization, just trying to help people learn science and learn about algae. And so it would be really great if your listeners can try to track us down.
What's the history of the Phycology Society?
I feel like it's 19th century.
It came out of botany. It
yeah.
actually came
right.
out of groups
right.
like the Linnaean Society and
right.
the Botanical Society
yeah.
of America. We were chapters focused on seaweeds, and then we launched in the 50s. We basically broke loose and became our own society as a bigger interest in algae evolved.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a whole world that is totally undiscovered, and it's inspiring. Like, I mean, just the physical work that you do outside and in nature and the fact that you're bettering our world is just lovely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you. It's been really fun talking to you.
Okay. Have a good afternoon.
So you've been listening to We Dig Plants on the Heritage Radio Network. Thank you to our guest, Dr. Michael Graham, for joining us and illuminating this underwater world for us. check out our Facebook page, Groundworks Inc., We Dig Plants, and our Instagram account at Groundworks Gardens NYC, and also Twitter at We Dig Plants. And we'll see you in the garden.
Happy gardening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.